So item number 11, 2019-20 Northrop Falcon policy. This is a briefing and public hearing. And Kyle.
What happened to that guy that wanted all the meetings open?
Illness or what, but he got really screwed up. He called me 6 months or a year ago. He's told me that.
Good afternoon, Chair Smith, Commissioners, Directors. I am Kyle Addix. I'm the Intergovernmental Salmon Manager for the FISH program, and I'm here today to talk to you about your North of Falcon policy. The current policy expires at the end of this month. So just a quick outline of what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to give you a brief on your current policy. I give you a more in-depth brief last month in Vancouver, so this will be a short one. Talk about potential modifications for a new policy, review the schedule for the policy consideration and potential adoption of a new policy, and seek your guidance moving forward. So again, just a brief summary of the policy. It tells the staff that our management decisions need to be consistent with a long list of things, including our statutory authority, various court decisions, the Endangered Species Act, Pacific Salmon Treaty, a list of management plans, state tribal agreements, that sort of thing, and of course with your commission policies. And the policy provides some general guidance to the department when we plan and manage our salmon fisheries. It goes through basics on conservation principles, providing harvest opportunity, in-season management, monitoring and sampling, enforcement and compliance, gear and fishery conflicts, minimizing incidental mortalities, and communications through the process. And lastly, it specifies that we will implement the policy consistent with the 21st Century Salmon and Steelhead Initiative, that it will be science-based, well-documented, transparent, well-communicated, and accountable, and that it will meet or exceed our ESA recovery and conservation goals. So back in Vancouver, we talked about some potential modifications to the policy. We brought to you the idea of changing the language for Puget Sound sockeye. I believe it was Commissioner McIsaac mentioned that we're referencing other policies, so we might want to think about how we reference those policies in this one. And we threw out the idea that it didn't necessarily need to be a two-year policy. It's not a policy that tends to change a whole lot from renewal to renewal, so we've thrown out the idea of making this a five-year policy going forward. In your materials with the summary sheet, you actually have a draft of a new policy. It's just the current policy with some strike through and modifications. So I'll just sort of walk you through those. So for Puget Sound sockeye, currently in the current policy, there's a reference to Lake Washington sockeye directed fisheries and a number of 200,000. The first 200,000 essentially going to recreational harvest and commercial harvest being considered after that. To put that in perspective, for the first 200,000 non-treaty, that would mean another 200,000 treaty harvest. With the current escapement goal, we'd need a run size of over 750,000 to even consider this. We haven't seen a run greater than the escapement goal since about 2006, so it's not a situation we're likely to see. We also have the Baker sockeye fishery, which has emerged in recent years, and we don't have any guidance on that. So our suggestion was just to replace the Lake Washington reference with the sentence, Puget Sound origin sockeye will be prioritized for recreational fishing opportunity. We haven't proposed any changes to the rest of that, so it specifies Chinook and Coho for recreational priority, Puget Sound pink to provide opportunities for commercial and recreational, and then for Fraser River, Chum, pink, and sockeye stocks and Puget Sound stocks, the majority goes to commercial fisheries. For the sections that reference other policies, we've added a sentence to each of those with the bold text here, just including any modifications made to the policy and any guidance or clarifications provided by the commission. So as the commission reviews these policies, potentially either makes modifications or provides guidance to the staff, this policy will say to consider those in addition to the policy. So we've inserted that for Grays Harbor, Willapa Bay, and also for the Columbia River section. I don't have a slide for it, but you'll see at the top of the policy, we've modified it instead of a 2019 to 2020 policy to say 2019 through 2023. We haven't proposed any changes to the communications section. We've been talking to public affairs about ideas, something like recording our public meetings and putting them up on YouTube. The department has a YouTube channel. The director's sort of virtual town hall is at the top of that page right now, but thinking of ways we could get more people involved if we could get those meetings out so people could watch them later. That would be one step. I don't think we have the ability right now to take questions virtually like you did in that town hall meeting, but that's one of the ideas we've been talking to public affairs to see if we could make work for 2019. There was some interest in just talking about other emerging issues related to North of Falcon, not necessarily something that would be included in the policy. This morning, in your written director's briefing, there was a summary of the Puget Sound Chinook Harvest Management Plan process. We were a little behind, and the director didn't spend time on that, but there is about a one-page summary in there I encourage you to look at. We talked briefly about the Skokomish River issue, which is something we continue to work on. So this is really a chance for you guys, if you have other questions that you want to ask today, I'll look at you.
So on North of Falcon, Kyle, you know way better than I do that one of the criticisms that's been levied against us is that everybody who wants to can't go to those meetings. You said in communications that you used the word YouTube, which I almost laughed. That's kind of the opposite end of the privacy spectrum. But you said the public meetings might be recorded and be able to view at a later date. When you say public meetings, are you talking about the actual North of Falcon meetings that that people are concerned that they can't get into?
Thank you, Chair Smith. Commissioner Baker, yes, we have some larger meetings during the process. We probably start with those, two or three meetings through the process. Typically, the first North of Falcon public meeting is our preseason kickoff meeting where we unveil all the forecasts and such. Then we typically have a North of Falcon 1 meeting that's in the Olympia area that gets more into fisheries discussions, and then have a second of those typically in Linwood later in the process. So we're thinking about those bigger meetings. If we could have a way for people to see what happened later, we think it would be a good thing.
Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. In regards to Barbara's question, and I'm not exactly sure what she was asking, but if she was asking about the government-to-government meetings being taped, that is not correct, is it?
Thank you, Chair Smith. Commissioner Carpenter, no, we're talking about the state public meetings, not the state tribal meetings.
Okay. Was that, Barbara, what you were asking?
I was wondering if there was a trajectory there, but thank you.
Yes, Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a couple of comments on emerging nations, but I'll wait until after public testimony. Even though I'm not sure I see some of the cast of thousands who said they're going to come and testify today. But on the matter of the policy document, so on your process, at our January meeting, we will be adopting a new policy. You mentioned it would go to 2023. So you would have a strikeout version, an add-on strikeout version for us to look at in advance of the January meeting?
Thank you, Chair Smith. Commissioner McIsaac, yes. After getting further guidance from the commission today, I would modify the document you have in your materials today. We would plan on putting that up on the web for public comment between now and the January meeting, and then we would come back with a strike-through version and a clean version. If the commission chose to adopt it, that would be the version going forward.
Thank you. Well, I think the changes you've got in there suffice. I would bring up one other thing as a possible piece of guidance. In November, we spoke just a little bit about the idea of in U.S. v. Washington and U.S. v. Oregon shooting for 50-50 as some sort of equitable sharing. And Commissioner Kehoe made the good point that former Director Anderson has noted that you know, it's not realistic to look at going river by river, run by run, and expecting at the end that that's how it's going to be for hatchery and for wild, and I completely agree with that. With regard to the point of starting with the intent that there be equitable sharing, going along with your very first slide where you bring up U.S. v. Washington and U.S. v. Oregon may be sufficient if the public understands that at the onset of the North of Falcon negotiations, in general, there is the intent to try to get the equitable sharing that I think is in those court agreements. I think that might be sufficient. You've got slide number 5 where it talks about accountability, which I presume is a phrase out of the policy, well-documented, transparent, well-communicated, and accountable. So in terms of guidance, I wondered about a post-season accounting rather than try to put something in there that gets into this delicacy of striving for 50-50 or striving for equitable sharing, and trying to explain that would be pretty difficult to get accurate. But in terms of I understand Section 10.4 of the Puget Sound Salmon Management Plan calls for some post-season accounting, and I'm not sure whether we're provided that already somewhere in our suite of post-season materials, but I just wondered your reaction, and I'm not trying to make a lot of work for people, but if there was in the policy some added provision that talked about some sort of a report to the Commission post-season that got to the question of how did things turn out with regard to equitable sharing. So would you view that as a monstrous workload, or would you view that as something you're already doing under Section 10.4 of the Puget Sound Management Plan and just don't do for the Columbia River, or any reaction you might have?
Thank you, Chair Smith. Commissioner McIsaac, a postseason assessment is certainly something we could provide. There is, especially for an area like Puget Sound with its mixed stock fisheries, there's a bit of a time lag. So soon after the seasons are over, we have catch estimates for the fisheries. There's kind of a lag with our modeling. We call it validation runs. As we go back and put the postseason escapement data and postseason catch data back through our fishery model and figure out what we think was actually caught stock by stock around Puget Sound. So we do that regularly, but there's a little bit more of a time lag than just a postseason. Here are the escapement estimates, here are the catch estimates. So it would kind of depend on the level of detail we were getting into and what the time frame for that sort of report was.
Well, maybe just as a follow-up, I could ask you guys to brainstorm a little bit on this question. There is a public perception out there that I think is wrong, that the department starts the negotiations and isn't even trying to get equitable sharing or 50-50, if people want to call that, in its biggest sense. And knowing that the mix of runs in itself may even prohibit that as you go through. But maybe you guys could just think about if there was something in the policy that then we could point to that say, no, that's not true. Maybe it's staying with just those two court cases and being able to speak to those. Maybe it's more. Maybe you could just think about that.
Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Baker.
So I think I understand that you will take what the product of today's meeting and put it on the website for public comment, which if we're going to do that, then Commissioner McIsaac, thinking about it is problematic. We need to do it or not, the thing that you're thinking about. And then my question is, I read through the changes that you've made in the draft and the policy, I think I see them all, except I may miss this, but you asked for a longer time limit, 5 years. I don't see that anywhere.
Thank you, Chair Smith. Commissioner Baker, that's just in the top of the document, the actual policy title and termination date.
Got it. Yeah, you got me that time. Okay. Thank you. So, good.
Yes.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a response to Commissioner Baker, and I completely agree that the best way of doing this is to get public comment on any phraseology that might be there. So maybe it would be, if indeed there are any ideas from the staff, and that you could label those as a staff, I don't want to even press you to call it a staff recommendation, but anyway, something so that it could go out for public review in advance so people could see it and say, oh no, we hate that language, don't put that in. Or maybe they wouldn't like it, I don't know.
I might add on the communication section and the questions on public meetings, we did have a plenary session with the tribes in Linwood that we talked about back in November, and we haven't sat down with the tribes yet. We do that in January to sort of go through the plan for all of our meetings, but we hope that we'll have another session like that in 2019. It was well received, and would like to see it happen again. We already briefly hit on the policy process, so we're here in December. We're going to take additional public comment when I'm finished, look for any additional guidance beyond what we've talked about from the commission, and then go put that draft online so that we can get it, the comments, and get it back to you before the January meeting. And we've already had some questions and guidance, but if there's any more.
Yes.
I think my question's for Commissioner McIsaac, so I can be clear on what you're suggesting, some additional language about post season review or of results, and the purpose of that would be to apply to next year, or just to communicate what happened in the season as a result of the negotiations. I just want to be clear on what we're thinking here.
Yeah, so the purpose here would be that there are some folks out there who believe that we begin the negotiations not striving for the kind of tribal, non-tribal sharing that people call 50-50. I think the language actually says equitable sharing, but in concept, equitable sharing. In the end, there's been many years, depending on where you count, where it does not come out to be 50-50 in a broad aggregate. And as Commissioner Keough indicated, there's many times where you don't come out 50-50 on a river by river. One river might favor one group, and the next river favors the other. But anyway, there's this perception out there that we're not even shooting for the right goal. So the idea would, and I'm not suggesting the commission endorse guidance for a postseason accounting, but I'm asking the staff to think about the idea of postseason accounting or some other idea, some other language that later we could point to those people who claim that and say, no, that's not true. It's part of our policy that's the spot you start from when these negotiations begin. So that's the idea.
Kyle, this might be a question I'll pose to you, and I think for your sake, Commissioner McIsaac, is that strictly speaking, and I think maybe that's, and Bob, I don't mean to speak for you, but I think to say that we're walking into that room with the idea we're going to go 50-50 on this is not accurate, in that we're talking about available impacts based on projected escapements, stream by stream, which have wide variability, and it's not as simple as, well, we started at 50-50, but we wound up somewhere in that range. It's a complicated formula that doesn't necessarily translate to as simply as a division of 50-50. There's several different factors that impact the available harvest on any one species in certain areas. And so I do know that what is available, just like we do on other fisheries, we have our forecast and then we have our actual catch. And we keep track of that on every fishery. And would that be true in Puget Sound as well, or the Skagit River tribal? And, you know, that information is available. It's just how that's interpreted may be difficult for someone that's just looking at a, you know, how did this come out? Well, it's different on the Skagit than it is on the Snohomish. So it would be difficult, I think, to interpret that as a ratio of a 50-50 balance. And your idea of keeping it consistent with the agreements that are already in place hopefully would satisfy people that were operating in the best interest of the state.
That's the intent, is to start there.
Yeah. Okay.
That's it. Good. Thank you, Kyle.
Thanks, Kyle.
And we do have three folks that wish to come up. And again, I'll call you up two at a time. Karen Rumors Cleveland, please. And Dr. Deborah Giles, please.
Call up Cindy first.
What?
Call up Cindy first. Before Karen, or after Karen.
Okay.
I reorganized them.
Oh, you did. Okay.
I did.
Okay. So it's Karen Rumors Cleveland and Cindy Hansen.
My name is Karen Rumors Cleveland. I'm from Friday Harbor, and I'm here as a concerned citizen, but I'm also the chair of the Marine Resource Committee in my county. And I work closely with our salmon lead entity, Byron Rod, on salmon restoration for the benefit of the southern killer whales. In Salmon Island, we feel like we're in the epicenter of an extinction that is in process. This summer, the whole world watched as Tahlequah swam thousands of miles with her baby on her head. It seemed like a long grief procession through all these waters. People were very, very touched, and all of a sudden the world started to pay attention to these whales, and so did the state of Washington. She alone galvanized the resource, and the resolve of the governor got action on the task force and made people aware of her family's plight. It's vital that we take her message seriously. So far, the harvest allocations of the various groups of humans have been discussed in Norfolk Falcon meetings, but the individuals that really have no other protein options are not at that table. The draft policy that is about to replace the old one still does not have any mention that the fish is needed to feed the salmon, to feed the southern resident killer whales. Until we humans are willing to count the needs of wildlife before we divide up our share of the harvest, we're just contributing to overfishing. The whales are starving right now because we have taken too much of it. They depend a lot on the Fraser River and salmon stock, especially in the summer. We know already that that is severely depleted. When there are salmon from that river, according to the policy as it's written right now, the fishery will be dedicated to commercial fishing. And that will just take the remaining fish out of the waters, and the whales will starve. For them to have enough food to eat, they need about 400,000 fish per year. That leaves the question of how much fish needs to be available for them to catch. I've been told that we need to have 4 million fish available in order for them to catch what they really need. So Norfolk Falcon has a big challenge this year. The whole world is watching. The whole world is paying attention. People are making major sacrifices, both for personally and business-wise. Mm-hmm. Restaurants have stopped serving Chinook. Grocery stores have stopped carrying it. People have stopped buying it, and many won't even eat any more salmon. There's another problem, and that is that there's a flaw in our collective messaging of what the whales really need. The study that we all draw our numbers from is a study that is actually broader than just Chinook. It also says that the summer diet is 80% Chinook. But in the fall and the winter, they are depending on other fishes as well. It's only 60% Chinook. So they clearly need other fishes, and so we need to make sure that we protect those as well. So I'm here to ask you, it's a big ask, please count their needs. Count their needs before you set the harvest quotas for the humans and modify the language accordingly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Dr. Deborah Giles, please, and Cindy Hansen.
Thank you. My name is Cindy Hansen, and I am here representing Orca Network. I'm also representing the Southern Resident Orcas because they currently do not have a seat at the table, as Karen said, nor do they have their own quota of salmon. So I'm kind of building on what Karen had said. We know that the Southern Resident Orcas are critically endangered with only 74 individuals left. This is due to a number of threats, with the primary factor being a lack of salmon, namely Chinook, Chum, and Coho. They are exhibiting changes in their pod structure and their culture, and they are spending only a fraction of their time in their traditional summer feeding grounds in the Salish Sea. Scientists have documented stress hormones and a high level of miscarriage, both of which have been linked to a lack of food. The Lacey et al. Model, published in 2017, determined that a 30% increase in prey would lead to the 2.3% increase in population per year needed for recovery of the southern resident orcas. There are multiple ways to achieve that 30% increase, and the Orca Task Force has made some good recommendations. However, Governor Inslee's budget only funded habitat restoration projects at less than 20% of what is needed. And a whale-watching ban is not going to result in an increase in fish. The few salmon recovery projects that do take place will need time to show results, and that is time that the orcas don't have. They are on a precipice right now. We need to take bold, immediate action if we have any hope of preventing their functional extinction in the very near future. The population as a whole requires 400,000 fish per year just to maintain the numbers they currently have, let alone allow for growth. Including them in ocean conditions is obviously not providing them with enough fish to survive and thrive. Therefore, I am asking that the southern resident orcas be given a separate allocation as you determine quotas for 2019. It is one of the fastest ways to provide immediate prey for them as we work on implementing the recommendations that came from the task force. Thank you.
Thank you, Cindy. And Dr. Giles.
Thank you. I'm Cindy.
I'm largely going to mimic what the two previous folks said, and I'll just give you a little bit more of the context with regard to one of the studies. So the southern resident killer whales need more fish, and factoring in the needs of this population of whales during the annual salmon fisheries planning process known as North of Falcom would be a bold and revolutionary way to make that happen. With conservative figuring, we know that each killer whale needs an average of 300 pounds of salmon per day to survive. That's about 15 20-pound fish per whale per day, or 405,150 fish annually. This does not seem like a huge number of fish to set aside to ensure the survival of this population of well-known and well-loved killer whales. A multi-year study of the nutritional, physiological, and reproductive health of the southern residents by Dr. Sam Wasser and colleagues, including myself, found that nearly 70% of all the pregnancies resulted in premature miscarriages, brought on by low or variable abundance of their most nutrient-rich prey, Chinook salmon. In most cases, the pregnancy ended in spontaneous miscarriage during the first half of gestation. However, in one-third of the failed pregnancies, hormone levels indicated that the calf was lost in the latter half of pregnancy or just moments after birth, as we saw with the case of J35 or Telequa's calf, only lived about less than a half an hour. So a third of those pregnancies are lost in this very, very late stage. when the females, therefore, are at a much higher risk of complication due to that loss. These females also showed signs of nutritional stress with ratios of thyroid hormone relative to glucocorticoid hormone nearly 7 times lower than females who successfully gave birth. These findings indicate that pregnancy failure brought on by poor nutrition is the major constraining force on the population growth of the southern resident killer whales. So anything that you can do to set aside a piece of the pie before it gets divvied up completely, let the whales have a place at the table and a piece of that pie. You guys are able to make that happen. And it's something that's never been done before. The whales should have an allocation. They are a tribe of beings that deserve food just like the rest of us. So I know you guys have an incredibly difficult job. I can't even imagine all of the moving parts that you guys have to keep track of. I'm lucky I just get to go out there and collect whale poop and analyze it, but the findings that we come up with are riveting and we can't deny them anymore. So thank you so much for listening to us and for taking our comments and for the work that you're all doing. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for making the trip over from Friday Harbor.
Come on up. Any of you are welcome to come out. Come on up on the boat and see what we do. We have a crazy dog that tells me where to drive the boat. The dog takes me to the sample. We collect the sample and analyze it, and we get this incredible amount of information. So all of you are welcome to come out.
To do that, it gets a little warmer out there.
Yeah.
I'm a fair weather sailor there. Well, thank you. We item number 12 is an executive session. We will not be going into that because the nature of that has been put off. So that will bring us to a close to the Friday meeting.
We're going to have a second part of that. We were going to talk about the RMP. Maybe we can just get Ron to do a briefing.
What were we?
What was the question?
I don't know. There were two parts, I think, intentionally on the executive session, one of which was going to be Director Susawen's part, and the other part, I think, was, and I don't know if it was noted under, but there had been some discussion about a briefing on the RMP, et cetera. Okay. That it, Ron? We don't need to hear any more today? Okay.
So we will go into recess until tomorrow.
1 second, he has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So these executive sessions are to have some discussions under the umbrella of U.S. v. Washington litigation and potential litigation. And we've asked for to be brought up to speed on any developments in the RMP as we move through the year since last January. So I would hope that in the January meeting that we'd be able to hang on to that purpose since we're not going to be able to do it today.
Do we note it?
Chair Smith, Commissioner McIsaac, with the developments from mediation, I think we can do it one of two ways. Because everything has become so public in, at least from an exchange of new information about what's going on with the Puget Sound Chinook Harvest Management Plan, we can either provide a briefing at the January meeting or do it with an executive session. I think that we could certainly give a briefing, therefore the public hearing, what you're going to hear, go to executive session to ask some of the detailed legal questions that might be going on or the integral negotiation questions that might be going on, maybe the better way to deal with it so that the public can hear the and see the information at the same time.
Thank you, Ron. You had a question?
No, I was just...
Okay, anything else?
Yeah.
Yes.
So we just heard some interesting testimony. I don't think it's in the task force recommendations. Harvest was considered, but that through our season setting process, we actually set aside some Chinook for the orcas. My sense is that we don't really have enough that it would make a difference to their starvation. But I just, is it something that we should talk to the co-managers? I mean, I don't think we should set aside our share alone, but the co-managers are concerned about the health of the orcas, and is it something that we should talk to our staff about in the January meetings when they start?
Chair Smith, just a little bit deeper into that issue, I guess. So part of the policy is following ESA. Part of the ESA evaluation for Puget Sound Chinook fisheries going forward will be what is the reduction in prey due to fisheries. So that is being considered. It's not a here's a magic number, don't catch this many that you might have caught, but it is part of the evaluation process is what's our best estimate for how many fish are out there available, what's the reduction due to fisheries. There'll be an assessment of what's the right level that will go into not just next year's Puget Sound fisheries, but as we work on the long-term RMP, that'll be part of the evaluation of that long-term RMP.
So that prompts another question. Has it ever been considered, because orcas have been listed for a while, has it ever been considered in the past then as part of the ESA considerations that go into season setting?
Thank you, Commissioner. Yes, it has. If we back up to 2010, which was the last year the co-manager submitted a longer-term Puget Sound Chinook RMP, as NOAA started their evaluation of that plan, they actually pulled back, asked the co-managers to shorten the duration of that plan, and engaged in what became an international with Canada independent panel review of killer whales and fisheries. So yes, it's definitely was a big factor in the last long-term plan and then an annual fisheries.
Thank you.
Mr. Carpenter?
No, Kyle took care of what I was going to say.
Okay. Anything else before? Seeing nothing else, we will go into recess until tomorrow morning at 8 a.m.